The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly, where today we'll look back at the 2005 Champions League final with Greg Bukowski, who was in Istanbul as Liverpool beat AC Milan on penalties after that amazing comeback. And we'll talk to our Scottish football correspondent, Ewan Murray, about what's going on in the SPFL and beyond. But right now it's a chance for me and Barry to say hello to each other. Hi, Barry.
Hello, Max. How are you?
Yeah, good. Got some questions for you. Matthew says, how is Barry staying alert?
Well, I'm in a constant state of alertness. I think the most alert I've ever been, possibly. Well, I said to you yesterday, it was while around cows when working with my father as a child, because once you've been kicked a couple of times by cattle, you tend to have your wits about you when you're in a yard full of them. But I did remember then once walking across a frozen lake in the grounds of Birr Castle Gardens, and I was on a state of high alert then until my good mate Enner decided, for no obvious reason, to start running out in the middle of this frozen lake. And we heard a crack of ice like a rifle going off, and there was some serious alertery there, and we all just, it was like a cartoon, you know, where the crack in the ice is following you as you run towards the bank.
For our non-UK listeners, this is because the government advice has moved from stay at home to stay alert, and there is no one more keenly alert than Barry Glendening. Joshua says, in the Korean League game on Friday, they had crowd noises playing through the sound systems. Could Barry provide his voice to the Premier League for when we eventually start playing behind closed doors to ramp up the atmosphere? Barry, are you in for that?
I would be in for it. I think you'd need a parental advisory, because there'd be a lot of swearing and loud sighing, and I'm not sure I would have the necessary enthusiasm required.
Could you just do, let's say Ashley Barnes fizzes a shot wide for Burnley, and then the Burnley PA announcer presses play. What would be the Barry noise for that, please?
Oh, fuck's sake.
I think it's a great idea. Orgazoid says, not a question, but I had a dream a couple of nights ago that I woke up and Barry was sitting on the edge of my bed, gently blowing smoke in my face. It was unsettling.
It wasn't a dream either.
Now, there is a new podcast, football podcast from The Guardian. It is called Forgotten Stories of Football. They are some of the long reads that we've done before, and they've been brilliantly brought to life by actors. The first one is called Football, Farce and Fascism. We'll play the trailer in a second. It's written by Paul Doyle, so it's obviously going to be interesting. And it is a fascinating story about football at the Olympics in Berlin in 1936, where Italy won 2 goals from a centre forward who wore glasses. Probably not the main thrust of the story, but it's worth
it. It should be.
I like football.
Were they
as well,
like tied around the back of his head with it?
like Ed Moses. I don't know, but yes, there are other parts to that story you might want to listen to. Barry, you've had a look down the running order of some of the stories that we're going to put out.
Yeah, well, there's one that caught my eye, I suppose mainly because Ewan is our special guest today, talking about the FITBA. It harks back to the 80s when Dundee United were a very good football team, and they were managed by Jim McLean, who Daniel Harris wrote the piece. He describes him as a tactical genius, a bully, a visionary, and an absolute barn pot. So I suppose he kind of reminds me a bit of Sir Alex Ferguson, before Sir Alex Ferguson was quite as famous as he would go on to become.
So we're going to drop episode one into our pod feed, wherever you get your pods. So have a listen, see what you think. The Forgotten Stories of Football, Football, Farce and Fascism. And after this, we'll play the trailer now. We'll speak to Greg Bukowski, looking back at the Champions League final in Istanbul in 2005.
Welcome to Forgotten Stories of Football, a new podcast series from The Guardian. Each episode features a great story from the history of football you've probably never heard before. From the captain of France who murdered for Hitler, to the Sheffield Wednesday top scorer who acted with Charlie Chaplin, to the story of how primetime TV inspired one of the sport's most shambolic appointments with manager idol. Forgotten Stories of Football spans 100 years of sporting history from across the footballing planet. Written by some of the world's leading sports journalists, the series is narrated by leading actors. Take a listen to this clip of Episode 1, Football, Farce and Fascism at the 1936 Olympics.
Britain came back only when the Poles relented and, through some overly rugged play, notably from Queen's Park's John Gardiner, who drew scorn from the crowd.
"The Poles were a lively lot and gave the British defenders a harassing time," reported The Guardian. "Gardiner annoyed the crowd by his hefty charging, and there was some booing when he bowled over God."
They meant the Polish forward Hubert Gad. So what appeared as a stupendous Nietzschean achievement is in fact the only known instance of a typo in The Guardian.
With the first episode debuting on Wednesday the 13th of May, listen out for The Guardian's Forgotten Stories of Football. Make sure you subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly, our chance to look back at the 2005 Champions League final in Istanbul. AC Milan 3, Liverpool 3, Liverpool winning on penalties. We'll do it with Greg Bukowski, who was at the game. Greg, how are you doing?
I'm very well, Max. Thank you.
Watching it back, I don't know how many times you've watched it back. How was it this time?
It was lovely. I felt quite emotional at the end. I was telling Jonathan earlier that I haven't watched it back that often because I was at the match and I was privileged to be at the match. And I like to remember what I saw on the night. So it is interesting watching it back. There was so much went on in the game. Obviously, we've just seen it the first half. There's despair at halftime at the situation we find ourselves in. And then just this extraordinary comeback. But the whole experience of being at Istanbul was quite something because it's so far away. I mean, for the final, it feels extraordinary getting over there. And the ground it was played in, the Atatürk Stadium, which was going to be the Champions League final, it could still be this year, it's like something that's landed out of space in the middle of a desert. It's like going to a match on Mars. And for everybody who was there, and I think this is probably the same experience Milan fans had and also journalists, it just took so long to get from Istanbul city centre out to that ground. So it felt like an achievement just getting to the ground in the first place. And then to witness what then unfolded was fantastic.
How old were you and who were you with? And tell us all of that.
So I went with my dad. I was 26. So, my peak years in football. And there was a lot of friends who went over from Liverpool, but we all went over at different times. Yeah, and this was one of the lovely things about being over there. And it felt probably more magical than it actually was, is that we just randomly bumped into each other because telecommunications weren't that great in Istanbul, and our phones were all we probably couldn't afford to phone each other, but we did all just manage to bump into each other in Istanbul, which felt very random at the time. But in fact, we'd all been corralled into one particular part of Istanbul, so that was obviously the reason why. But it felt great meeting up with everyone.
I don't know about you, Barry, but before this game, I'd kind of forgotten what kind of side AC Milan had. Pelé had named his list of the 125 greatest living footballers the year before this game, and there were six in Milan's starting lineup. You've got Dida in goal, a back four of Cafu, Stam, Nesta and Maldini, Pirlo, Gattuso, Seedorf and Kaká in midfield, and Crespo and Shevchenko up front.
Yeah, I mean, on paper, AC Milan were the vastly superior team. And I'll be honest, I think on the pitch, they were the vastly superior team as well this night. I mean, Carlo Ancelotti had a look in his book to see what he had to say about this game. And he, interestingly enough, said he has no regrets. With the benefit of hindsight, he wouldn't have done anything differently. And he said that Milan were superior for 114 minutes. Liverpool were superior for six, and that was enough for them to win it. Now, I wouldn't necessarily agree with him entirely on that, But AC Milan, some of those players must still be kicking themselves at how they left this one behind them. And I know I'm going to make Liverpool fans cross by saying that, but I think they were the vastly superior team on the night.
Liverpool's team is Dudek, Finnan, Carragher, Hippier, Traore, Luis Garcia, Gerard, Alonso, Risa, Barros and Kewell ahead of them. It almost doesn't compare, does it?
The secret weapon, Jimmy Traore there. We knew what the Milan team was. We knew what that Liverpool team was going to be like because we'd gone through the whole season with it. And it was like watching two Liverpools. There was a Liverpool in the league who I think lost 10 games and were so inconsistent in the league. Ended up 37 points behind Chelsea. And that was that team almost seemed like a different team. It's like a split personality. In Europe, this Liverpool team came to life, and you saw that in the comeback against Olympiacos when Liverpool needed to score three goals in the second half. So there was your practice run before what happened in Istanbul. They also beat Juventus over two legs. Juventus that season went on to win Serie A. We're then ahead of Milan, but were then stripped of the title after the Calciopoli scandal. And so it wasn't. There was no fear really from a Liverpool fans or players' perspective of the Milan team because that it was just a continuation of what they'd already been doing in Europe.
In my mind, and when I watched that game for the first time, you know, Milan blew Liverpool out of the water in the first half. I don't know if either of you felt that Milan were necessarily three goals better than Liverpool in that half.
I think maybe because Milan scored was two goals in the last 6 minutes probably gave them an air of superiority. You know, it's like the Rolling Stones thing these days. Mick Jagger, he's quite placid at Rolling Stones gigs until the encore, and then he really gives it welly, and that's what the fans leaving remember. So if Milan score two goals late in the first half, it probably gives them an air of dominance. But I thought they were pretty dominant and worth the three-goal lead. And Greg was saying that apparently going in at half-time, Jamie Carragher has since said he was wondering, or he asked someone, what's the record score a team has lost the European Cup final by? That was his way of thinking, you know, we can't be the worst ever. Certainly wasn't thinking about really winning it.
That was exactly what I was thinking as a fan at half-time. I was thinking, could this be, you know, 6-7-0 humiliation. But I also, just watching that back again and you know, looking at it, knowing how it pans out, I do think the first 30 minutes was a pretty close game, and Liverpool switched off completely for Maldini's goal. But after that, it wasn't. Milan kind of just, I don't know, maybe this is part of their game plan, that let's just see what Liverpool have got. And, you know, it seemed like an even game for 30 minutes. But then I did think that the last 15 minutes of that first half, Kaká started to really come to life. Pirlo was playing the role ball around Gerrard in midfield. And I think Gerrard did look lost in that role alongside Alonso. This was before Mascherano came to Liverpool, who, you know, was a good, obviously a fantastic defensive midfielder to allow Alonso to pass the ball. But I think Gerrard looked like he was trying to do all the jobs, put the fire out everywhere, and that's what led to a change at half-time, although we'll come to half-time, which was, in fact, chaos.
The second goal actually comes in kind of what now would be a huge VAR controversy, because it looks like Nesta's handballed it when he's lying on the ground in the Milan penalty area, and then it goes right down the other end. Shevchenko, who looks five times quicker than he ever was in a Chelsea shirt, this is just a year before he went to Chelsea, crosses it and Crespo scores. And then Crespo, who's on loan from Chelsea at the time, scores this absolutely glorious goal. That pass from Kaká. I mean, the ball comes to Kaká and he shields Gerrard in this one sweeping move and then plays this side foot pass. It is eye of the needle stuff. Carragher stretching and can't quite get it. And Crespo's finish is just unbelievable, isn't it?
The finish was something to behold, because there's a slow motion of it, and he seems to hit the ball or dink the ball with the outside of his foot, but yet get the kind of spin on the ball you would get with the inside of your foot, which it must have been a fantastic advert for Predators, which he was wearing at the time.
So half-time comes, and I've interviewed Didi Haman about this, because obviously Didi, in the sort of history, the way it's written, is that Haman saves this whole game for Liverpool. And I talked to Haman about this, and he says the man that really deserves praise is Jimmy Traore, right? Who's a kind of figure of fun. And when you watch this game, you can see why, right? He doesn't look very good. But at half time, he was told to come off. His kit was off. He's in the shower. Mentally, he's finished the game. And then Steve Finnan says, I'm injured. And so Traore has to put his kit back on or get a fresh kit.
He put his kit back on, got a fresh kit. But then I think Finnan then said, no, actually, I'm okay to carry on. Then he decided he'd start to get undressed again. And then Finnan did say, oh, no, actually, I can't. And so Traore's mind must have been in, I don't know, to focus on the second half, given that he twice thought he wasn't going to feature in. It was something else. And then he makes a very telling clearance off the line in the second half, which keeps Liverpool in the game.
And meanwhile, Steven Gerrard is what, telling Rafa to leave the room so he can give a kind of peace with inches team talk.
I read this today. Gibril Sissé, according to legend, he said that Steven Gerrard gave the best team talk he'd ever heard at halftime in this game. He apparently asked Rafael Benitez and his coaching staff to leave the changing room. And then he said, according to Sissé, he said that he's a Liverpool kid. This has always been his club. He didn't want to see his club like this, being humiliated. And he said if we scored in the first 15 minutes, we would win the game. And he's the guy who scored the first goal. Now, I mean, these things can be overstated and history is written by the winners. You know, I still remember from earlier this season, although it seems like decades ago now, where Liverpool were warming up for a game on BT Sport. I think it was a Saturday lunchtime game or something. And James Milner was just going, you know, lads first to every ball. Lads, you know, if we go a goal behind, we need to get another goal. Just basic stuff, basic captaincy by numbers stuff you say during a warm-up. And BT were selling it just because they happened to catch it on camera, like some sort of Churchillian address, which it really wasn't. So, you know, this may be the same. And I'm not having a go at James Milner at all here. It's just, you know, we get a little peek behind the curtain and we blow it up to something far more important than it actually is. But yeah, according to Gibril Sissé, who, let's not forget, at the time was the Lord of the Manor of Frodsham. Mm-hmm.
Explain that story for those who haven't heard it before.
Well, when Gibril Sissé signed for Liverpool, he bought this property somewhere
in Cheshire. Yeah, Frodsham in Cheshire. Yeah.
Frodsham in Cheshire. And with the property came the title Lord of the Manor of Frodsham. So Gibril was the Lord of the Manor of Frodsham. And I would suspect possibly the coolest Lord of the Manor of Frodsham of all time. But yeah, so he said that Steven Gerrard's halftime pep talk was the greatest he'd ever heard. And there's also stories, and I don't know how, I can't vouch for the veracity of them, that the Milan players were celebrating and pogoing in the next door changing room because they were 3-0 up. So yeah, I've no doubt they were probably happy and delighted to be 3-0 up and there'd be a few high fives going around, but I reckon Carlo Ancelotti would have slapped down any premature celebrations pretty quickly.
Do you think, watching it again, that Didi Haman does change this game? I mean, he's a clever footballer. We were talking about it during the game that he's not amazingly athletic. He's not amazingly quick. He doesn't have an amazing touch. He doesn't have amazing distribution. He's not brilliant in the air. Yet, he is a really, really effective footballer.
I think one of the key things is that the formation changes and you have three centre-backs, two wing-backs and therefore midfield, then you've got Haman anchoring it. Gerrard is then pushing further forwards and actually pushing Milan back in that game. But, I mean, we were watching it and saying, well, what is Haman actually doing? But he just seems to be in the right place at the right time. And, you know, there's some players seem to have that ability about them. Their greatest kind of asset is their positional sense, which isn't the sexiest attribute to have. But it's very handy in games where, you know, in tactical games. And I guess he was the perfect player for Benitez to put on there and to to essentially bring the shape back to the team, because in that 15 minutes before half-time, Liverpool did lose the shape really badly. And I think you can see the influence Gerrard has in that second half. He really does start to maraud around and play the role that Kaká played in the first half for Milan.
I've actually been watching the Last Dance documentary on Netflix about the Chicago Bulls during the 80s and 90s. And I suppose you could say Didi Hamann, he's a bit like, he's the Dennis Rodman of the team. He just instinctively knew where to be to destroy, to break up stuff. Him coming on, whether it's him personally or the change in formation that his appearance resulted in, it did make a big difference.
Greg, just watching this game and this comeback, when you're in the stadium, did you have time to take it in goal by goal? Because it just happens so quickly that from the moment that Gerrard scores that brilliant header, before you can even relax for that, it's 3-2 and then it's 3-3.
And that's the thing with these Liverpool performances in Europe, where it's something, this emotion seems to take over. And because we'd beaten Olympiacos at Anfield in the group stage, final group stage game, and Gerrard kind of kept the show on the road with that incredible goal. I do think after the goal that Gerrard scored to bring the game back to 3-1, there was a belief that, okay, there's one goal, there's enough time on the clock. He scored that within 10 minutes of the second half starting. And then definitely we didn't believe it was on after the first goal, which some fans possibly did. The second one did feel like a hammer blow to Milan's confidence. And the mood changed completely. I mean, it was looking back on that goal. I mean, Smicha hit a very clean strike, but Dida gets two hands onto it and doesn't keep it out. It slips through, and you're just thinking this could be our night after all. And then when Gerrard goes down for the penalty, there's a feeling then that something strange and magic is happening here, and it's beautiful and brilliant, you know.
Are there Scousers crying all around you?
I can't. This is the thing. Look, thinking back now, the whole thing just seems like a dream, like a wonderful dream. But because of where we were, and it was creeping on towards midnight when the game finished, it was somewhere near 12:45 in the morning, I think. It felt like we were kind of at a festival or something, or, you know, some kind of, I don't know, it did feel particularly different to, I guess, how maybe the Champions League finals feel now that I played in Europe and a little bit earlier.
And it's because you said when we were watching the game, Greg, that when you left and it was time to go home, obviously there was elation, but everyone was just absolutely shattered.
This was the thing. Fans had been going to Istanbul because this was a time when the match was still played on a Wednesday night. It wasn't a Saturday night like they are now. So people had taken time off work to go over there, and you know they'd been at it quite heavily on days leading up to it, or possibly on the day itself, but had been up early as well. So by the time it got to the match and we'd been through this ringer already, 56 minutes, and it's 3-3 and emotions are all over the place. Obviously, a lot of people had drunk a lot, and it had taken hours and hours to get out to the ground, which felt, like somewhere else. It felt like survival. It felt like the fans and the players did really feel very closely connected in that they were knackered. We were knackered. There was big, huge gallon tubs of water coolers that someone had they'd got them from the back of the stadium because there was nothing left to drink. So they just started to throw water coolers into the groups of fans that we were all just passing around and drinking just to stay on our feet. So when you see Carragher like on his haunches,
he's so fucked, isn't he?
We could all very much relate to how he was feeling just as fans, because we were just trying to stay alive in there. And thank God we did, because we had a great time.
And it is interesting, after the you get back to 3-3, not a whole lot happens. There's Traore's goal line clearance. Kaká has a chance where Stam heads the ball and it's at a corner and Kaká can't quite get enough on it. Then it gets to extra time. Then you've got this weird situation where Steven Gerrard is playing right back. Carragher, as we've said, is gone down with cramp. I mean, almost like every other minute, Smeech has got cramp. And then we get to this incredible moment where Shevchenko has this chance. Dudek makes one save, and then somehow the rebound doesn't go in. And I mean, were you at that end, Greg?
Yeah, that's the thing. So at the end of the ground I was at with the Liverpool fans was the end where no goals were scored. So all six goals and all the penalties were scored at the other end. So it felt like there was some magic force field at that end, because when Dudek made that the save, the double save, if we didn't believe we were going to win at that point, previous to that, then we definitely did believe after that save that this was going to be Liverpool's night, because there was no... call it instinct or whatever, but it didn't seem to make sense that Shevchenko, who was the pre-Chelsea Shevchenko, who was cool as you like, absolutely assassin in front of goal, doesn't score there when he had all that goal to aim for. Maybe we should, maybe Shevchenko should be coming in for it more so than Dudek being praised for the save, because he really has so much goal to aim for and he doesn't go in.
It was interesting actually listening to the, I think it was an ITV commentary we heard. It was Clive Tilsley, who I love, I have to say, a big fan, but he seemed quite appalled that it was this brilliant game was now going to be settled by, and I quote, a fairground sideshow.
I mean, the penalty shootout is, Sergino misses one, absolutely balloons it over the bar. Pirlo takes Milan's second penalty. And it's funny watching Pirlo going out to take a penalty, because in my mind I'm like, well, he's obviously going to score, because, you know, I've seen him score penalties quite easily in quite big games against England, for example. And Jerzy Dudek is, I mean, it's not exaggerating to say he's on the edge of his six-yard box.
He's pretty much in Greece, I think, by that point. And Pirlo has nowhere to go. Like, he's so far off his line. The angle is narrowed so much. But then, thank God, there's no VAR, you know.
When they do the trophy lift, right, it's like Jamie Carragher has just had about 20 pints and is just lying against the bar. Like, he's joining in for a bit and then he's just on the end. He can't move, can he?
No, he's in some amount of pain, and it must be a bittersweet moment that at the time when the trophy's lifted, he is unable to physically control his own body, and he's trying to and he's trying to hold his legs to make them do what he wants them to do, but they won't. So instead, he's just bent over, and fair dues. I'm sure he doesn't mind.
Yeah, and actually, Baz, you pointed out he did somehow summon up the energy to sprint faster than he'd sprinted in the whole game when Dudek saved Shevchenko's penalty.
Yeah, he was the first of the Liverpool players to lead the charge to sort of embrace Jerzy Dudek, which is quite funny considering how absolutely banjoed he was with cramp for the half hour leading up to that.
You made an interesting point, Greg, about how important this victory was for Liverpool in terms of those things we don't like to think about that much, like global brand and legacy, because it had been so long since they'd won a major trophy.
Well, no, I mean, there was the 2001 treble with Houllier, where they won the UEFA Cup in the golden own goal against Alaves, and the FA Cup and the League Cup. So it felt like something was happening there, but then that did fizzle out, which is why Benitez took over. But I think, you know, going back to the big prize in 1990, which was the last league title. It had been 15 years. It had been 20 years since the last European Cup final Liverpool had been in, which was the horrors of Heysel. So I think for the generation of fans, or particularly my generation, there hadn't been the, you know, early on in our lifetimes, we'd known Liverpool winning the league and being a consistently good team. But it felt so important that for perhaps other fans who hadn't followed Liverpool for as long to see that they, you know, this team was still worth watching and still could entertain and could still win a major prize, almost kind of propped up by its own history, because looking at the squad, they had no right to go on and beat that Milan team or to beat the Juventus team or to come back against Olympiacos. So it was a really important moment, I think, because after that, you come forwards now. They won the FA Cup in 2006. Then there was the the horrific ownership under Hicks and Gillett. Dalglish propped the club up again. Rodgers almost won the league. And then 14 years later, Liverpool win the European Cup again. 15 years later, quite possibly, hopefully, going to win the league. It seems like it was the last big trophy that the club won as the old kind of fashioned club it was, because it was still run by David Moores and it hadn't yet passed over in terms of ownership. So I think it kept the club there as a global name at a very important time.
Can I ask you, Greg, back then you were, I think, 26 years old, footloose and fancy free, and now you're considerably older, wiser, you're married, you've got young kids. Which incarnation of Liverpool do you prefer, that one or this one?
It's a very interesting question, Barry, because I love this Liverpool team. I think Klopp is brilliant, but this era of Liverpool feels like it belongs to a newer breed of fans. This group of fans who they have these things called Boss Nights, and they all go and sing their own songs, and you know, it feels like it's a different way of supporting Liverpool. Whereas, and it's great. I love all what they're doing, but I'm not as connected with it as I was with the Evans, Houllier, Benitez years Liverpool, because I was going to every game. I was still living in Liverpool, and I had a season ticket, and I suffered a lot in that time. So to get to a Champions League final, having beaten Juventus, who went on to win the league, although they had it revoked, Chelsea, who were unbelievable last season in the league. They'd just won the league 3 days before Liverpool knocked them out at Anfield in possibly the greatest atmosphere I've ever experienced, and many other Liverpool fans having that 1-0 game. And so it just felt like that was just something magical about this Champions League win. And you know, and I was I love Klopp's team beating Barcelona last year, going on to win a very poor final against Tottenham. But it did feel like there was something special about Istanbul because of the team that Liverpool were facing and all the hurdles they had to overcome.
This has been a very Liverpool-centric view of this game. It is worth looking at from the Milan angle because, you know, a month before this, they were on course to win Serie A and win the Champions League.
Yeah, and I mean, and this wasn't, I don't remember, you know, going through Milan's results at the time in 2005, but had I would have seen that the game prior to the Champions League final, I'd have seen that this Milan team was playing Palermo and were 3-1 up in that game and let that lead slip and drew 3-3, funnily enough. They then went on to draw the final game as well. And from a position where they were leading Serie A, they choked and Juventus won the league. So it was almost like a microcosm, this game, of what they'd been doing in the league in terms of their own form.
And this game forced UEFA to change one of their rules as well.
Yes, because Liverpool were so poor in the league, finishing 37 points behind Chelsea, that they finished fifth, therefore not qualifying for the 2006 Champions League. And they were allowed to go in at the first qualifying stage, which was a really odd game because it was at Anfield and it was against TNS, Total Network Solutions, who were the Welsh champions. And there was a full house for this game because obviously it was a celebration of the Champions League win, the first game back at Anfield. And I think it was in July. And there was a lad playing up front for TNS who I'd played with at Marine called I think his name was Michael Jackson. And I was just looking at him, just thinking, I was playing like football with you just not too long ago, mate. And look at you now, like, you know, kind of stomping around Anfield against the European Cup winners. And he lost 3-0, but you know, what a nice night for him.
Just a few tweets that have been sent about this game. Marco says, "This was a nightmare. I'm an AC Milan fan. On that evening, I was also playing the last match of the season with my football team. The year after, I'd have left Italy to study in Tunis for a year. We won, I scored. Pretty odd since I was a right back. I remember we sat in the front of our club TV in between halves, and we couldn't believe we'd won the game so easily. We had a party after our match, basically forgot the final. Long story short, it wasn't as funny when I remembered to check the score. Dom says, I was living in Istanbul at the time and teaching at an international school. Georgi Hadji's daughter was in my class. He was Galatasaray manager at the time, which is how I got my tickets for the game. Tim says, we left at half time to catch the last bus out of Copacabana in Bolivia as there were riots starting. Quite surprised when I got to Peru at the score. Greg, there are loads of stories about people leaving the ground at half time. I don't know how many are true or not.
It is true. I saw fans who just had enough and just didn't want to see their club humiliated and just, you know, would have rather gone back into Istanbul and got back to the bars early and start to have a drink and just forget about what they'd just seen. So, I mean, more fool them, I suppose. But there was a sour mood at halftime, and that did change with I think, all the fans singing You'll Never Walk Alone and deciding to give it, you know, another go. And it did work out. But it's definitely true that there were fans who left at halftime.
And that hat you're wearing right now is a hat you were given on the night, is it?
No, so this is the thing. I was so lucky compared to so many other people who went, because I got on a coach. I'd stayed over the night before with my dad in Istanbul, and we'd had a night out. So we had a full day in Istanbul. But we got on a coach afterwards, which took us straight to the airport rather than back to Istanbul, because we had a flight out that night. Now, we got there and there was just chaos at the airports. No, everything was cancelled and delayed. But I just happened to go up to somebody and just say, well, you know, are all the flights gone to Liverpool? And they just said, oh, no, you've just stuck this one there, just get on that one. And it was like getting on a bus, you know. It's like, okay, there's a spare plane there. So me and my dad just kind of went through whilst all these people were lying around on the floor, just absolutely done in, like they'd just done a marathon. And we were on the flight before we knew it. And everybody on the flight fell asleep immediately because they were just done in, completely done in. I was so fortunate that I managed to come back to Liverpool, whereas a lot of my friends got stuck in Istanbul and weren't able to get back. And I walked into the city centre, managed to climb up the St. John's Centre shopping centre car park and then stair lift onto what was like a little asbestos roof, which was, you know, a death trap, to look down on where the bus was going to come round in front of St. George's Hall. And I mean, there's just something about Liverpool fans managing to climb just anything. I mean, this season they didn't. In 2019 they changed the route because there were fewer things for people to climb on the Strand. Whereas when it was in the city centre in front of the St. George's Hall, Lime Street Station's glass roof was just full of fans. The shopping centres around were full of fans, and it was just it's just incredible to see so many people just manage to find a spot to see this bus come by, and it was great to see, you know, both ends of it.
It's a health and safety nightmare, Greg. That's what it is.
It is, and I wouldn't recommend anyone does it themselves.
Fast forward to now, Greg. I just wonder how your feelings about Liverpool winning this title have changed, sort of since the day before lockdown and now.
I had a ticket to go and see Liverpool play Everton at Goodison on the Monday night before the shutdown of the Premier League. And there was still a possibility, had Man City played that weekend, they obviously didn't because Mikel Arteta tested positive. But there was still a possibility that Liverpool could have won the league at Goodison. But yet, I remember talking to my dad in the week beforehand and just saying, well, I don't really feel like, even if the match goes ahead, that it's right to travel. And I think obviously this is soured the title, but it's understandable why it's soured the title celebrations as they might have been. And I think I just look back now at what has been an incredible 30 odd games that Liverpool have played, and thinking it felt like Liverpool won the title at times towards the end of before the shutdown, like when they beat Manchester United at Anfield, and just those moments. And I think that's what it is. As much as you would love to have the celebration at the end, you've got to celebrate the moments along the way. And there's been some incredible games: the defeat of Man City at Anfield, the comeback against Aston Villa, It's just, you know, it's been pockmarked with fantastic performances, and I think that's something to look back on and be proud of, regardless of the fact that Liverpool get to celebrate with loads of fans all huddled together, because that just doesn't feel right. And if it's not right for football to return, then so be it.
All right, then, that'll do for part two. Greg, thanks so much, mate. Appreciate it.
Thanks very much. Enjoyed it.
And me and Baz will be back in a minute. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's find out what's happening in Fit Bar with the Guardian Scottish football correspondent, Ewan Murray. Ewan, how are you doing?
I'm good, Max. I think a good haircut wouldn't affect. How are you?
To be honest, your hair looks pretty. It looks like you might have had a go at it yourself or got Mrs. Murray to do it.
No.
How are you finding lockdown? All right?
It's been fine. Just no golf events to travel to has been a bit strange, but possibly be able to play golf now. Just awaiting details on that, but yeah, that's not been too bad.
We had a lot of questions that went along these lines from Michael. Given the drama with the SPFL, is it fair to say Scottish football is actually more entertaining when there's no football on? You've been quite busy, haven't you, Ewan, to be fair?
I have. Listen, there's a serious point to that, and one that's existed for a few years. There's a theory that you just have to accept the drama and the theatre which forms the backdrop to Scottish football, because it is more entertaining than what actually happens on the pitch. And if you get your head around that and just accept it, then you probably won't get upset and annoyed about it. So I think there's a, you know, it's obviously a kind of amusing point, but I think there's an underlying element there which has got truth in it.
And you and Scottish football fans, particularly fans of Rangers and Celtic, are famous for not getting upset or annoyed.
Yes.
About...
And perspective. They're famous for perspective.
So let's just rewind to the start. Football was postponed in Scotland on the 13th of March. There was a lot of talk about the best way to move forward, restructuring, voiding the season, etc. Then there was a vote and a lot of confusion over whether Dundee had voted or not, or where their slip of paper had gone, which caused Rangers to call for the chief exec of the SPFL to be suspended pending investigation, and had Hearts owner Ann Budge talking about legal action. Remind us what happened then.
I'm glad you've summed it up better than I could, because it would take me about 3 days. It's difficult because there's so many elements to this. The Dundee vote and everything that happened around it is very important. They sent a vote against the resolution, which would have, you know, knocked the resolution down to end the season. That ended up in a quarantine folder, so we're told. And in between it being removed from the quarantine folder, Dundee said, don't count that vote. And then 5 days later, changed the vote to yes, and the resolution passed. In the middle of Dundee's deliberations, there were questions raised by clubs about the Hearts mentioned the undue influence placed on clubs by the SPFL board. The board were adamant this resolution had to pass. Rangers, as you said, raised questions about the governance around the resolution. And then when Dundee eventually passed the resolution with their vote, all hell continued to break loose around the circumstances of the resolution and the voting allowances and structures that went on.
And where are we now?
There's an EGM tomorrow where Rangers request for an independent investigation into various elements of this. They laid out 7 bullet points. Will be discussed. Rangers need 75% of the membership to vote in support to get that investigation. I don't think they'll get there, but I also think there's no chance whatsoever that this will die down and go away. I mean, you work in this environment, you're used to some kind of vitriolic circumstances. The 2012 situation surrounding Rangers was pretty nasty at times, but this feels more extreme than what we've encountered. It's very personal, it's very nasty, and it's getting more and more bitter, it feels like, and quite personal in a lot of ways. And I don't think there's any chance it's going to die down or go away soon. Partly actually because there is no football. There is a vacuum there that to an extent needs filled, but in my view, there's a lot of serious questions about the governance of Scottish football now coming to a head that need to be investigated.
You and a lot of people, myself included, would have heard Rangers complaining about this and immediately thought they were being paranoid and there was hatching some wild conspiracy theory. In your opinion, do they have a case to feel that they were misled and that this has not been run properly?
I'm not sure but misled. I think they've certainly got a case to feel it hasn't been run properly. I mean, this is quite difficult to do, but if you remove Rangers from the equation, I took some notes before I sat down here. So Inverness have referred to arrogant, aggressive mismanagement. the Stenhouse Muir chairman has spoken about negatively about the culture of the SPFL, and when he raised that, his concerns were dismissed. Hearts mentioned undue influence in terms of the vote. Partick Thistle have criticised divisive language by the SPFL and indeed the way that they were relegated. They're one of three teams who have been unfairly, quite obviously, harmed by this. Falkirk say they were deceived and misled. And the Lowland League chairman, now the Lowland League is one of the leagues that forms a pyramid below League Two, he spoke about pressure from the SPFL. So difficult though it is to do, and I think quite frustratingly people are happy to paint this as a Rangers against the SPFL argument. It's not. I think if you look at the body of sentiment, and I know it's not the majority body of sentiment, but there's enough of it that I think we should be looking closely at how the SPFL is behaving, because the overall message of how they govern the game isn't impressive at all.
And Rangers produced a 200-page long dossier, which I'm sure you must have enjoyed reading. The SPFL have said they found nothing in it that suggested they'd done anything wrong. Did you find anything in it that suggested they'd done anything wrong?
I don't know where this 200 pages, unless I got the wrong dossier. There was 53 pages, then a 27-page appendix and a 19-page appendix. So I don't know where this became a bit of a thing. Maybe I get a different dossier. I read things that, as I say, generally raise questions about the way the SPFL behave. I mean, the crux of the point is they were in an almighty rush to get this resolution passed to stop the season. And they were adamant that the only way they could distribute end-of-season money was to get this resolution passed. And the haste with which they did this, I think, is open to question. And there are clubs, I spoke to a lower league chairman yesterday, there are clubs who voted in support of this resolution who would now vote for an investigation because they've been suitably upset by the SPFL's behaviour since the vote, and indeed the vote passed. So Rangers, a lot of it was governance. Some of it was new, some of it wasn't particularly new at all. But do they have a point? Yes. Do the other clubs have a point? Yes. And the SPFL is very, very vocal in trying to knock down this wave of dissent and tell clubs basically, there's a pandemic going on here, let's get on with this, and trying to save Scottish football rather than focusing on the way we run the game.
What would the SPFL's argument be about making this resolution so hasty?
Well, I don't know, and that's a key question. They say, the language they used was that if the resolution didn't pass, clubs would face weeks of financial uncertainty. I mean, the language they used, I don't want to use the threatening, but it was very strong that this clubs were desperate for the money. Now, that's true for some clubs, but a lot of them, and actually particularly the smaller clubs, the amount of money we were speaking about here wasn't going to make or break them, and didn't make nearly as much of a difference as the SPFL portrayed. And now we're 5 weeks down the line, and the Premiership, the top league, still hasn't been called. So the vast majority of this money, it was a total of 9 million. 7 million if it still hasn't been released. So their haste didn't make any sense at the time. It doesn't make any sense now. They should have found a way, in my opinion. They were adamant they couldn't, but they should have found a way in exceptional circumstances to separate the calling and defining of the league from the distribution of money, and even factor reconstruction of the leagues into that. And that would have caused far, far, far less, if any, resentment than the path of action that they took.
Do you have any idea where this is going?
I don't have any idea what will happen. What will be interesting is whether there's now a sufficient lack, as I say, I don't think Rangers will get the 75% investigation threshold, but is there a sufficient body of support that there's a lack of confidence in the executive of the SPFL? That would be the important thing for me. I mean, this isn't a one-off example from the SPFL. Last season, they tried to arrange two semi-finals at the same ground on the same day because they said this was the only way to do it, until it transpired it wasn't the only way to do it and they could move one to Murrayfield, as the Scottish Rugby Union rubbed their hands at this customer coming to them, having messed up another option. The Ladbrokes stopped their title sponsorship months ago. The league doesn't have a new sponsor for next season, and I dare say, given current circumstances, that will be even more difficult. This isn't an isolated case of negative attitudes in the game towards those running the game. If it was, I think you'd be more inclined to say, okay, give them a bit of a pass. But you know, there's a body of, and there's umpteen other examples of things that the SPFL have done, which I would say questions their competence. I mean, there's a fundamental problem with Scottish football whereby the clubs run everything. The clubs run the league. I would argue there should be, this is a broader point, but there should be an executive management that runs our game. That removes vested interests and gives fresh and inverted commas independent eyes on what's going on, because the current governance system is it doesn't work.
So it's a different structure to the Premier League?
I don't know exactly how the Premier League works, but I mean, the Scottish Premier League is I mean, the Hamilton, Motherwell, Rangers, ironically enough, these clubs represent 8 of 10 board members or something like that. The clubs completely run the show. Now, whether it's more tribal or rancorous in Scotland, I don't know, but that is their model, which recent evidence has brought into the fore. It doesn't work. It needs to change.
We've talked a lot about the survival of football clubs in England, specifically League One and League Two, but also higher up the pyramid. Do you worry for the survival of some Scottish football clubs, a lot of Scottish football clubs?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many unknowns. I'm anxious not to paint a bleaker picture than might be necessary, but yes, I do. You need to remember Scottish clubs at professional level, the gate receipt revenue is more important to them than TV revenue. Well, it's not more important. It represents 43% of their income, which is a higher percentage than elsewhere. Now, they have a new television deal kicking in August. This goes back to part of the rush that the league had to conclude last season, so that figure will change slightly. But Scottish football relies to a large extent on people coming through the gate. Now, if you take the not unreasonable position that people aren't going to be coming through the gates, certainly in large numbers for a while, then that raises questions, I think, actually, about the big and medium-sized clubs rather than the smaller clubs who their costs are lower. They don't carry a lot of players. A lot of players are out of contract in the summer anyway. Their business is supported by a lot of volunteers, etc., etc. So clubs in the Premier League and Championship, I would think, particularly, are the ones who are at risk here.
Your own club Hearts, look set to be relegated. Would you feel very hard done by if that happens, or is it fair enough because they've been pretty garbage all season?
No, it's not fair enough. My position in this is, in a football sense, I don't care what league Hearts play in. In fact, going to the Championship, I think, might do them good. They can reset. They'll shed players. They'll shed costs. They can start again and build up goodwill and build a football structure which is going to work far better than the last one ultimately did. So I have no reservations about playing in that league at all. But on a sporting basis, I think it's completely unfair that you relegate teams before the season has been completed. I think in the midst of a pandemic, it's completely unfair, unquestionably, that three clubs only and a members organisation are disproportionately penalised because of what's happened. So Hearts and Partick Thistle, I think, will be relegated by 0.4 of a point or something. Remember the points average situation? They had a game in hand whilst bottom of the league. And Stranraer. Now, to Stranraer, it's less of a financial hit going from the second bottom tier to the bottom tier. But the point remains, you're harming these clubs in a situation where we should be looking out for each other. And, as I say, on a sporting league basis principle, it's completely the wrong thing to do. And that's before we go into the circumstances of how the SPFL have conducted themselves during this situation.
A question from Matt says, was there any merit to the idea of Scottish football going to three leagues of 14 beyond possibly saving a few clubs from relegation this season?
Yeah, well, not even. I mean, to me, the solution to this is, so there are two teams underneath in the pyramid structure who would have been involved in a playoff. To me, the simple solution is you put two teams extra into the Premier League with no relegation, and you bottom up with those two teams coming into the bottom league. How you structure that, I don't feel strongly about. It could be 14, 10, 10, 10, 14, 14, whatever. There were various models mentioned. But that eliminates that unfairness that they don't need to apply. So, yeah, I would have supported something like that completely. It's a path of least resistance, basically.
South of the border, Brighton have had a player test positive. They're third after two contracted it earlier in the crisis. Both have since recovered. Norwich City's Todd Cantwell quoted the BBC tweet reporting this news, adding, quote, "We are just people too." In Germany, the entire squad and staff of second division side Dynamo Dresden are in quarantine after two of them tested positive. Bundesliga chief exec Christian Seifert remains confident that the season will restart this weekend. Five new cases have been reported across the two top leagues in Spain. Paul McInnes in The Guardian saying the Premier League faces a week of chaos after hopes of government direction on project restart were dashed by the Prime Minister. Basically, Boris Johnson last night not mentioning professional sport at all. The Culture Secretary, Oliver Dowden, if you remember 2 weeks ago, said the Premier League should return as soon as possible, a remark that had raised the hopes of officials, and the Premier League moved their meeting from Friday to today so they could reflect on what the Prime Minister said. There was a question from Paul Barry that said, why are struggling teams who are poor at home obsessed with playing games at home in empty stadia when football restarts? It's quite a good point, isn't it, that these sides that have come out and saying it's completely unfair to be at neutral grounds weren't that great at home already this season?
That may be true, but they were probably better at home than they were away. They just haven't been very good at all. Apparently, Gary Neville, I think, suggested that the games all be played at the grounds of teams who are under threat from relegation. I don't know if that's a good idea or not. I mean, there's so many bad ideas and so many ideas, it's getting ridiculous. I believe that the government are going to talk about getting professional sport going again tomorrow being Tuesday, which is not much use to the Premier League ahead of their meeting today on Monday. But I still will be astonished if there's any professional football played in England before August at the earliest. I do not see how it can work. Still waiting for a single person from a single club, like a club hierarchy, to stand up and say, yes, this, we are happy to do this. We want to play now and it will be safe. I'm not that interested in seeing the Premier League restart in a sort of zombified form that no one will really like, even though some will pretend they're loving it. But Barney compared it over the weekend to Weekend at Bernie's, you know, the Premier, likening the Premier League to this corpse that's being ferried around, pretending to have a great time when deep down we all know it's really dead. But I would quite like to see Todd Cantwell playing, because he had quite a luxurious Buffon before all this started. And after 7 weeks without a haircut, I would be interested to see how he rocks up.
It's the 37th anniversary today of Aberdeen beating Real Madrid in the Cup Winners' Cup final in Gothenburg. I think for younger listeners, would never believe that Aberdeen would ever play Real Madrid, let alone beat them in a European Cup final. And it was John Hewitt's header in extra time. It's a brilliant goal. Interesting members of that Aberdeen side: Jim Leighton, Alex McLeish, Willie Miller, Gordon Strachan, Mark McGee. Alfredo Di Stefano was the Real Madrid manager. Aberdeen's squad was entirely Scottish. Real Madrid's only had two non-Spaniards in Uli Stilicker and Johnny Method. And that Aberdeen side were a pretty damn good side, Ewan, weren't they?
And what about the manager? Whatever happened to him?
Yeah, he did okay.
Yeah, and then they won the Super Cup as well, didn't they? They beat Hamburg, I think. And I think they beat Bayern Munich on the way to beating Real Madrid, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, I mean, those were, dare I say it, far more interesting times where A, the Scottish League Championship, you know, was not a monopoly or a duopoly, because Aberdeen then and the Dundee United could and did win the league. But also they could compete with the best teams in Europe. That Aberdeen team, quite rightly, is revered there. And it was the platform for Alex Ferguson's subsequent and stunning success.
Gav says, which of the 9 away trips in the Championship is Ewan's favourite?
Queen of the South from the last time. Dumfries is a good place. Yeah. I've been to Arbroath, but not to see Hearts play there. I'm thinking more. I've been to Capello Morton, but not to see Hearts play there. Yeah, probably Dumfries, because it's a nice day trip. As I said, on a social and football level, I have no problem at all with playing in that division. In fact, in many ways, it's more fun.
And finally, Chris, who's been the grisliest Scottish manager you've ever had to deal with?
I suppose that's people who would intimidate you, I think. What do you think, Barry? Is that what he means?
Yeah, I'd go with that. Alex Neil is immediately springing to my mind as not so much grisly as just rude.
He was fine when I interviewed him, but the last time I saw him, he was the player manager of Hamilton. I saw him sent off at Dumbarton for headbutting an opponent whilst the player manager. He's done a very good job at Preston, to be fair. He could have gone under the radar.
I may just have got him on a bad day. I mean, he was Norwich manager and they'd just been beaten, so I suppose it's fair enough.
With an undertone of menace.
Yes, definitely.
It's a great team talk after the game, isn't it? All right, well, listen, Ewan, thank you so much for coming on. Appreciate it and shedding some light on that. And
it was a pleasure.
I'd say we'd get you on again when it's all resolved, but that means we won't speak to you for about 25 years. So.
Chat to you when there's some semblance of normality.
Cheers, Baz, for your time.
You're welcome.
We'll finish with chapter 8 of 10 of Detective Wilson. Scandinavian Steel. It was chaos in FWPD Towers as the alarm blared. Hordes of people rushed out of the building as though the opposition had just scored a winner in extra time. The Bear led the way, with Wilson and Flo following suit. But something was niggling at Wilson. He stopped in his tracks. "What the fuck are you stopping for?" Barry asked. "Something's not right." Wilson turned to Flo. "Can you radio the lockup and see if that memory stick is under lock and key?" Flo pulled out her radio and pressed the button. "Evidence lockup? Sergeant Okwonga, please respond. Over." The three of them listened intently to the white noise, waiting for the reply. Eventually it came. "Okwonga here. Over." Flo ploughed on. "Yeah, just want to check that you've checked in the evidence that D.S. Langdon dropped off. Over." They waited again for the reply. Wilson hoped more than anything that he was wrong. Flo became impatient. "Do you have D.S. Langdon's evidence? Over." The young desk sergeant finally replied. I haven't seen D.S. Langdon all week, I'm afraid. Over." Unfortunately, he'd been right. Flo sprung into action and grabbed two more radios from a nearby dock, tossing one to each of them. "When you get eyes on Mark, call in your location." She sprinted off down the hall. Before Baz left, Wilson grabbed his arm and lowered his voice. "Someone is working very hard to keep this information under wraps, Baz. As soon as we get our hands on it, we need to go public. It's the only way to make sure no one else gets heard." "What do you suggest?" the Bear asked. Wilson pointed to a TV that someone had left on in the office. It was tuned to the Game channel, where fiery face of the network, Gabriel Marcotti, was in the middle of one of his trademark rants. "On our heads be it then," sighed the Bear. The two men headed into the bowels of the building, just like old times. D.S. Mark Langdon couldn't help but smile as he plodded through the car park. He was going to finally be able to hammer the last nail into Jonathan Wilson's coffin and hopefully take down DCI Glendenning as a bonus. He'd joined the FWPD around the same time as the two of them, but no one ever talked about his arrests. No one ever talked him up for promotion. It was all Glendenning did this or Wilson did that. Everyone else was left plying their trade in the lower leagues as those two shot up through the ranks, but now it was his time. As he made his way through the dimly lit car park, passing pillar after pillar, he finally spotted a nervous-looking Rushton fidgeting in a bay. "Did you get it?" the lawyer asked in a hushed tone. Langdon presented the stick. "Piece of cake. What now?" Rushton breathed a sigh of relief. "My source from Internal Affairs said to meet here." Langdon heard footsteps echoing and turned to see a man walking towards them through the shadows. "Internal Affairs," came a voice. "Do you have the evidence?" Yes, Max stammered. "Right here. But I want assurance that I'll be the prosecuting attorney when Wilson goes to trial." Langdon could feel the man smirking from the darkness, but there was something else. He knew that voice. "Of course," said the mystery man. "We wouldn't have done this without you." Why did he know that voice? Why didn't this feel right? He opened his mouth to demand the stranger identify himself, but it was too late. The last thing Mark Langdon saw was a flash of light, and the last thing he felt was the cold kiss of the concrete floor. Wilson stood outside the car park door. The sound of the gunshot had torn through him, but his nerves held firm. He knew that the killer awaited him on the other side of the door. He had tried to leave this game behind, but apparently the game had refused, dragging him back into the fold like a Scholes or Henri. A part of him wanted to turn around and walk away, as he had done once before. Wilson thought about Cochrane. He thought about Roker. He thought about away days and terraces, the euphoric highs of promotion, the crushing lows of relegation. He thought about Darren Bent standing tall. He thought about Connor Wickham saving the day. He thought about everything Amazon were trying to take away from the sport he loved. He thought of Flo or Baz being in danger. Once more, he thought of Sam Diss. Wilson knew what he had to do. He took a breath and stepped into the darkness. In the dimly lit car park, he saw Rushton on the floor, blood pouring from his head, giving him the appearance of a young Terry Butcher. Next to him, D.S. Langdon lay prone in a pool of blood. That was when he heard a voice that he hadn't heard in a very long time. Out of the shadows, with a gun in his hand, stepped another old friend. Unbeknownst to the killer and Wilson, there was a third man run coming from the shadows. The extra man was a Scandinavian who enjoyed dinner for breakfast and spoke with a bewildering Gaelic twang. He had recognised the killer in the cafe earlier and decided to follow him. Now that he had the suspect zonally marked, he was about to make his presence known. So, the penultimate episode of Detective Wilson is next. You decide, the fall of the bear or one for the team. We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.